Okay, for this beginning of this hour and then the end of this hour, I'll tell you two stories that come from Russia. The one I'll tell you now is from the time of the Tsars. The one in the end of the hour will be at the time of the communists. Now, as a historical background, during the Tsars period, the Russian army was known to be extremely anti-Semitic, and part of their policies periodically to raid the Jewish shtetls, the Jewish settlements in the Russia area. They would kidnap all the boys from about the age of 10 onward and make them force them to be serving the Russian army in some capacity and for about 20, 30 years before they could ever visit home again. And that's the background. And it's a story of a Russian rabbi sitting in a train, one of these cubicles that would seat 4 to 6 people. He was there by himself because nobody wanted to sit in the same cubicle where a Jew was sitting. But suddenly the door swings open. There's a Russian military officer in his uniform with his medals. He sees the rabbi, doesn't want to sit with him, slams the door shut, tries to find some other place to sit, but the other seats were taken. And it's going to be a very long ride on the train, so he had to find a place to sit, and so much to his chagrin, he had to go sit where the rabbi was sitting. The benches were facing each other. This rabbi was sitting here reading his rabbinic Hebrew books, and the officer was sitting here, giving the rabbi dirty looks and just scowling at him. The rabbi learned to ignore those things a long time earlier. But suddenly the Russian officer breaks his silence and says, "What makes you Jews so smart?" Rabbi says, "I beg your pardon." And the officer says, "We Russian officers were discussing this issue. We've noticed that the Jews seem to be smarter than the Russians. What makes you Jews so smart?" Rabbi says, "We're smart because we eat a lot of herring." Officer says, "Eating herring makes you Jews smart?" "Oh yes," said the rabbi. "We Jews eat herring 3 times a day. That's why we're smart. I have a jar of herring in my hand, which I will have for lunch, so I can stay smart." Officer says the rabbi, "Would you sell me that jar of herring?" Rabbi says, "Yes, you can have it for 25 rubles. Officer pays him 25 rubles, and the rabbi gives him the herring, which he eats very quickly. And when he's finished, he tells the rabbi, "You know, back in Moscow, I've gotten a lot more herring for only 5 rubles. Rabbi said, "See, you're smarter already." All right, let's move on to a third element in chapter 11, the 7th trumpet. So verse 14 declares this to be the third and the worst of the 3 woe judgments, which is the 7th trumpet. And verse 15 makes an announcement: as a result of the 7th trumpet, the Messiah is now to inherit the kingdom of the world. Notice the word kingdom is singular, because at this point of time, there's only one world kingdom, and that is the kingdom of the Antichrist. But now the Messiah will take over this one world kingdom as a result of the results of the 7th trumpet. The verses 16 through 18 points out what the 7th trumpet will accomplish: destroy those who are destroying the earth. And what he's describing here will be the results of the 7 bowl judgments of chapters 15 and 16. So what this shows is that just as the 7th seal contained the 7 trumpet judgments, by the same token, the 7th trumpet will contain the 7 bowl judgments. And that'll be the worst series of judgments of all. And then verse 19 provides the heavenly prelude to the bowl judgments. Let's look at it for a moment because it'll play a role again in chapter 15 and 16. So let's go to chapter 11 and verse 19. It was open, this is verse 19, it was open, the temple of God that is in heaven. Notice the focus is on the temple of God, not the earthly one, but the one in heaven. And there was seen in his temple the Ark of his covenant. And there was seen in the temple that followed lightnings and voices and thunders and an earthquake with great hail. So as the chapter comes to an end, the scene is in heaven, and again convulsions as they are before all three series of judgments. And this is a short version of what we'll see happening again in chapter 15, verse 1 through chapter 16, verse 1. 15, verse 1 and verse 16, 1. So basically, he gives you the events in heaven just before the bowl judgments, but then he drops it until chapter 15. And following the law of recurrence, which now comprises chapters 12, 13, and 14, it comes back to some earlier segments in order to show some other events that will begin to move from the middle into the second half before the actual bowl judgments are going to be put out. And so we come to chapter 12, which involves Israel in the tribulation, in chapter 12, verses 1 through 17. And this is the one key chapter in the book that's going to deal with Israel in the tribulation. And as he does before, as though we've seen him do before, he will do so again in the verses 1 through 5. He's going to go back to a historical background to explain why there's so much animosity against the Jews. Now, parallel to what's happening here is Matthew 24, verses 15 through 28. So again, in verse 15, Messiah gives the warning about the upcoming abomination of desolation. In verses 16 to 19, as I mentioned, the Jews are told, when you see the abomination of desolation in the temple in Jerusalem, get out of the country and get out of the country very, very quickly. And the illustrations I gave you previously is at the rooftop, don't come down to take any possessions from inside the house. If you're playing in the field, don't go back to living quarters to take even a coat. From where you are, hitting the ground from the roof or where you are plowing from that point, just get yourself out of the country and do so very quickly. That we haven't covered yet is what he says in verse 20, and that is the event is going to happen, but pray it won't happen on one of two occasions, that it won't happen either in the winter or on the Sabbath day. Well, why not in winter? It seldom snows in Israel, so what could be the problem of winter? There's some differences between our country here and Israel, and one of these bit of differences is the weather pattern. So in this country, we get rain in all four seasons, summer, fall, winter, and spring. That's not the case in Israel. Israel has a fixed rain season pattern, rains begin at the end of October. And rains will fall in the months of November, December, January, February will begin to peter out in March and finally die out by mid-April. So from mid-April to mid-October, no rain falls. Another key difference is the way highways are built. When Americans build a highway and come to a water gully, even if the water gully is a dry gully, the American way is to build a bridge across it. Not so in Israel, where these roads were paved into water gullies and up out again. Now, technically, these gullies are known as wadis. That's spelled W-A-D-I. W-A-D-I. A wadi is dry all of summer. It's also dry most of winter. But in the winter season, when the rains begin to fall on the mountain ranges of Israel, water begins rushing down these wadis, carrying tons of rock and debris, often destroying the highways. So more than once while living and driving around Israel, I would have to make a major detour, because a wadi destroyed a highway just that way. Now, Israelis like to hike these wadis. Many of them are rather picturesque and continue hiking into the fall months, not realizing that the rain season had begun. And it may not be raining where they're hiking, but it has begun raining elsewhere. And so I get two newspapers from Israel, one Hebrew and one English, and I get a news magazine also from Israel, and every fall, the reports of Israelis killed that way. So if this happens in the winter months, it could make escape that much more difficult. How difficult it could be happened when I was a student at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and there were 40 French tourists walking down a wadi heading for an archaeological site. It was not raining when they were hiking, but suddenly began raining elsewhere, and suddenly the water started to come down. Within 30 minutes, 38 of these 40 French tourists drowned, only two survived. Jesus says, pray that your flight be not in winter. Secondly, don't pray won't happen the Sabbath day. What's the problem on the Sabbath day? On the Sabbath day, from sundown Friday till sundown Saturday, all public transportation closes down. No trains are running, no buses are running. Unless you have your own automobile, here again, must make escape that much more difficult. So the event is going to happen, but you're just a prayer request that it won't happen either in the wintertime or on the Sabbath issue, because it'll make a quick escape that much more difficult. And the reason behind all this, he finally spells out in verses 21 and 22. And that is, at this point, they're facing worldwide anti-Semitism. And now Satan inaugurates a worldwide program. It's going to be a Nazi-style program to annihilate every Jew living at this point of time. In verses 23 to 28, there was a special message for the remnant, that these are the Jews who believe during this period of time, not to believe any rumor. The second coming has occurred, he's over here or he's over there, because the second coming will not be like the first one. The first one was very private, and only a few people knew about the first coming. But the second coming will be very different. And he points out in verses 28 and 29, the whole world will be enveloped by blackness and darkness. There'll be the fifth of the world's five blackouts. There'll be no light coming to earth for the sun, moon, and stars. And suddenly, this worldwide thick blackness will be dispersed by the coming of the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory light. And that will signal the actual second coming, which the whole world will see. And therefore, don't believe any rumor that he has not come. You will know, as the whole world will know, when the second coming has finally occurred. Now, with this background from the Gospels, in chapter 12, verses 1 through 5, he begins with a historical review to clearly spell out why Satan has this special animosity towards the Jews. And in verses 1 and 2, he sees the vision of a woman arrayed or dressed with the sun, moon, and 12 stars. Here again, it goes back to the Old Testament, Genesis chapter 37, verses 9 through 11. And from that passage, we learn that the sun represents Jacob, the moon represents Rachel, and the 12 stars are the 12 sons of Jacob who in turn fathered the 12 tribes of Israel. And so this woman throughout this whole chapter represents the people of Israel, the Jewish people, portrayed as a woman because throughout the Hebrew Bible, Israel was the wife of Jehovah. While the church is the bride of the Messiah, Israel is the wife of Jehovah. But in verses 1 and 2, at a certain point of history, which is just before the birth of the Messiah, just before the first coming. And what he sees next in verse 3 and 4, I should have shown this earlier. The sun represents Jacob, and you see evidence of this in Isaiah 40, verse 27, chapter 49, verse 5, and Jeremiah 30, verse 10. The moon represents Rachel, who represents Jewish motherhood in Jeremiah 31, verse 15, Matthew 2, 18. The 12 stars, the 12 tribes. So again, the nation of Israel, just before the birth of the Messiah. At this point in verse 3, he sees a vision of the dragon, who he'll define to be Satan a few verses down. And this dragon has 7 heads and 10 horns. So what it shows is that this is at the time of the final form of the four Gentile empire. The final form of the four Gentile empire, but the empire is under Satan's control. He wears a diadem, which shows his conquest from the position of royalty. And what we read in verse 4 is that he gathers all of the demons from all over the world to try to destroy the child when the child is born. It is here that we learn how many angels fell with Satan. 1/3 of all the angels God created fell when Satan fell. The good news is that we outnumbered them 2-1. But shows how the percentage of those who fell, 1/3. And what he's referring to here is what happens in Matthew 2, verses 16 through 18. And the first attempt to try to destroy the child was at the slaughter of the babes of Bethlehem. But throughout the life and ministry of the Messiah, he makes a number of attempts to have him killed, either at the wrong time, either before or after Passover, or in the wrong way, like by sword or by stoning. And all such attempts fail with a simple statement, his hour was not yet come. Now keep in mind, it was not merely his death that was essential for the atonement. If that was all that was necessary, then him dying as a 2-year-old in Bethlehem with the others would have been sufficient. But it would not be sufficient. The death had to come at a specific point of God's timetable, a specific Passover, in a specific way. And the attempts are made to kill him at the wrong time, in the wrong way. And this passage also explains the sudden increase of demonic activity that we find in the Gospels. As you read the whole history of the Hebrew Bible, you'll cover about 4,000 years of human history. Demons are mentioned here, some there, they're not very dominant or prominent. When you get into the Gospels, all of a sudden you have this massive explosion of demonic activity. Everywhere the Messiah goes, he's confronted by demons. When you get past the Gospels into the Book of Acts, the demonic activity suddenly drops down to what it was in the Old Testament times. Now keep in mind, the Book of Acts is the longest book in the New Testament. It covers about 30 years of early church history. Demons are mentioned only 4 times. Now the guy who wrote Acts also wrote Luke, and Luke, demons are everywhere. Book of Acts, they're almost nowhere. And the gospel period is a very unique period of time in that normally Satan has his demons spread throughout the world doing his bidding, but during the time just before Messiah was born, he gathered all of his demonic forces to be within and around the land of Israel to try to thwart the purpose of the first coming. And that's why the demons are so prominent and dominant in the gospel period. When you get past the gospel period, which is already after his death and resurrection, and he failed to avoid it, therefore demons are once again spread throughout the world doing his bidding. So the standard is not the gospels. That was unique because he was here. But the standard is what we see before and after the gospels. The demonic activity is there, but it's not so dominant as it is uniquely in the gospel because Jesus was here. As we've seen in the book of Revelation, as we come to tribulation, once again, there'll be a massive increase of demonic activity. But this is unique. All those attempts to try to avoid the death of the Messiah at the proper time and the proper way fails. And in verse 5, the child is caught up into heaven at his ascension from the Mount of Olives. The Messiah is still destined to rule all the nations of the world, but for now he was caught up into God unto his throne. He's ascended to heaven. He's now seated at the right hand of God the Father, awaiting his return to finally set up his messianic kingdom. But what is required for his return? We'll get to this as we move through this chapter. So this is all historical information. The reason Satan hates the Jews is because before he came, they were the ones who will produce the Messiah. And when they produced the Messiah and he failed to kill the child when he was 2 years old, then during the gospel period, he does everything he could do to have Jesus killed at the wrong time, before or after Passover, or in the wrong way, like by sword or by stoning. But now the child is caught up to the God's throne. And now his animosity to the Jews is to try to destroy them to avoid the second coming. And that's the point we're getting to as we move to this chapter. So in verse 6, we find ourselves in the same place as we saw in Matthew 24, verses 15 to 22. The woman Israel is now fleeing. And the flight occurs at the midpoint of the tribulation, which was also true in Matthew chapter 24. And she's able to escape into the wilderness. We haven't pinpointed where she runs to as yet. But in Matthew 24, the geography where she flees is the mountains. Here we have a second indication, into the wilderness, which is desert territory. Also, it says in verse 6, to a place God has prepared in advance, a pre-existing place. A pre-existing place. So whatever place we locate, it has to meet all three requirements. And there she is hid for 3.5 years. Now, while verse 6 says Duman is fleeing, it didn't say why she's fleeing. This is now explained in verses 7 through 12 of chapter 12. And verse 7 points out, in the middle of the tribulation, there's going to be an angelic war that'll break out. It'll be Michael and the holy angels, of whom Michael is the archangel of, and there'll be Satan and his fallen angels. It'll be the war in the Strait of Bord. He now lives in the atmosphere. You'll see this in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 2, Ephesians 2, 2. He's the prince of the powers of the air. The prince of the powers of the air. You also see it in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, Ephesians 6, 12. He lives in the heavenly places. And while he lives in the atmosphere, he has free access into heaven, as we see him using in Job chapters 1 and 2. And he goes up to heaven, he goes as an accuser, accusing two different groups. First of all, he is Israel's accuser, accusing Israel of their sins. But second, he's also the accuser of their brethren. So a believer falls into unconfessed sin, eventually Satan will appear before God to accuse that believer of his sin. He also has free access to the earth. Now, God gave to humanity the authority over the earth in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. But when man fell, Satan usurped that authority. So in John chapter 12, verse 31, John 12, 31, he's the prince of this world. The prince of this world. 2 Corinthians 4:4. 2 Corinthians 4:4. He's the God of this world. The God of this world, the God of this age. And also in Luke chapter 4, verses 5 through 7. Luke 4, 5 through 7. He is the prince of all the kingdoms of this world. He can offer them to whomsoever he wills. And so he now runs the earth as a result of Adam's fall. And what happens now that the war will break out in the present abode of Satan, which is the third abode, he'll now be confined to his fourth abode. He'll be cast down to the earth. He'll be confined to the earth for the second half of the tribulation and loses his access into heaven. And God gives the archangel victory over the anointed cherub, Satan, and they're all confined to the earth. So he's now cast down to his fourth abode in verses 8 and 9. Michael and his forces are victorious, and now Satan is confined to the earth for his fourth abode. In verse 9, we're given several of his names, five altogether. He's called the great dragon, which emphasizes his fierceness. He's called the old serpent, which harks back to the Garden of Eden, where through the serpent he spoke to Eve and caused humanity to sin. The third name is devil, which means he's an accuser. His fourth name is Satan or Satan, which in Hebrew means an adversary. He's called a deceiver because he's a master counterfeiter. And although the Bible calls him the angel of this darkness, he still appears as an angel of light, part of his deceptive program. And Satan's confinement to the earth in verses 10 through 12 will result in two major results. In the verses 10, 11, and 12, his access to heaven is now removed. So no longer will the saints in heaven have to hear an accusation against one for whom Messiah died. He no longer has the option to accuse the brethren. And so verse 12 says, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and ye that dwell in them." Those who live in heaven no longer have to hear these accusations. However, the second result is for the earth, and it's quite the opposite. And the second part of verse 12 says, notice, "Woe for the earth and for the sea, because the devil has gone down unto you having great wrath, knowing he had but a short time." As for the earth, the result is one of woe. And the reason for the woe is because he now knows this time is short. How short? 3.5 years before the second coming. And therefore, knowing this time is short, 3.5 years before the second coming, it is now woe for the earth. Woe for the earth. Now notice how verse 13 brings together the thoughts of verse 6 and verse 12. Verse 6, the woman is fleeing. In verse 12, the reason is the wrath of Satan. And now we read in verse 13 and 14. "And when the dragon saw that he was cast down to earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man-child, who had given to the woman the two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly into wilderness unto her place, where she's nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent." So the reason the woman is fleeing is because she's now targeted by the wrath of Satan. He now initiates a special policy of persecution to try to annihilate all the Jews of the world. Now, Israel flees into the wilderness from the satanic persecution. She flees to a specific place. She'll be nourished for 3.5 years, meaning God will give her divine provisions as she flees all the way to the place of flight. Now, the text also points out that verse 14, again, that's the figure of a flood. They were given verse 15, "And the serpent cast out his mouth after woman, waters as of a river, that he may cause her to be carried away by the stream." And also this is the figure of a flood trying to destroy her. When the word figure of a flood is used symbolically, it's always a military invasion. So after he's captured the temple compound, after he declared himself to be God Almighty, and when the Jews began to flee, he sends the army to try to wipe out the Jews as quickly as he could. Same way as Pharaoh, when the Jews were stuck at the shores of the Red Sea, Pharaoh changes his mind and sends his army against the Jews. But as he did supernaturally with Moses, he'll do supernaturally here, because he's done this before, and he'll do it again. The earth will open up and swallow this army being sent against the Jews. And there uses the word of the wings of the eagle. As we said yesterday, this has nothing to do with anybody's air force. It's a figure of speech already found twice in the Hebrew Bible, and means a successful escape after being pursued due to divine revelation. That word "or" should be "of." A successful escape after being pursued due to divine intervention is the way that is used in Exodus chapter 19, verse 4, also used the same way in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32, verse 11. So in verse 15, the initial attempt to destroy the Jews by military invasion and military tribulation fails. Then 11, verse 41, he says he shall enter into the glorious land. The glorious land is Israel. Revelation 11, verse 1 and 2, there'll be a Gentile takeover of the Jewish temple. And Matthew 24:15 is the abomination of desolation. And keep in mind, that is the signal for the Jewish people that they must flee the land. And in verse 16, the invasion fails insofar as trying to destroy the Jews initially. As we come to verse 17, the verse goes on to point out, Satan will now continue the war against the women, this is Israel as a whole, and he will no longer create his Nazi systems to try to destroy every Jew living. But then notice what it says. Verse 17, dragon waxed wroth with the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed. And who's the rest of her seed? The word could be remnant of her seed, that keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. That keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So he's going to war against the woman in general, the Jewish people in general, but it'd be especially targeting the Messianic Jewish community of that day, those who are believers in the Messiahship of Yeshua, Messiahship of Jesus. So why is he warring against the Jews in general, and why is he targeting the Jewish believers? Now here's where we have to deal with the precondition to the second coming. The rejection of the Messiah is detailed in Matthew chapter 12 and 13. In Matthew 12 and 13, they reject the Messiahship of Jesus and they accuse him of being demonized by the prince of demons, Beelzebub. That became the official Pharisaic basis for rejecting him. And what happens at that moment is the ministry of Jesus now changes radically, and it changes in four areas. First of all, the first change has to do that he now withdraws the offer of the Messianic kingdom from Israel. They lost out in establishing the kingdom at that point of time. And secondly, they now face a coming physical destruction for that rejection, which will finally come in the year 70, AD 70, Roman destruction of the city and the temple. And that led to the forced dispersion of the Jews around the world. There's still more Jews outside the land than inside the land. Now, and the dispersion continues. But the key passages now, I don't know if I put them on here or not. Okay. Take your Bibles and turn, first of all, to Leviticus. Chapter 26, Leviticus chapter 26. When Moses wrote Leviticus 26, it was all prophecy. But now in the course of Jewish history, most of this chapter has already been fulfilled. And he points out in the sweep of this chapter, when the Jews enter the land, they will fall into periods of disobedience. They'll bring on different forms of divine discipline. First of all, would be subjugation, and also fulfilled in the days of the judges. Secondly, captivity, fulfilled by the Assyrian and then the Babylonian captivities. But then thirdly, a worldwide dispersion. And a worldwide dispersion came as the direct result of the rejection of the one like unto Moses, the Messiah. So by the end of verse 39, the worldwide dispersion is a fact, and so the first 39 verses has been quite literally fulfilled. And now we come to verse 40. They shall confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers, in the trespass which they trespassed against me. And also that because they were contrary unto me, also were contrary unto them, and brought them into land of their enemies. If then their uncircumcised heart be humbled, and they then accept of the punishment of their iniquity, then will I remember my covenant with Jacob, and also my covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham will I remember, and I will remember the land. Notice in verse 42, what God says is that he has every intention of fulfilling all of the unfulfilled promises of the Abrahamic covenant, especially as it pertains to the borders of the promised land. He says, I will remember the land. But the precondition of enjoying the benefits of the promised land is found in verse 40. They must confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers. Now notice two things. The word iniquity is singular. And it has a definite article, the iniquity, meaning there is one specific sin that must be confessed by Israel. It was a sin that was committed by their fathers, their ancestors, and then continued by them that must be confessed before they can enjoy all of the benefits of the Abrahamic covenant and, more to the point, all of the privileges of having all of the promised land. Now let's go to Jeremiah chapter 3. Jeremiah chapter 3. In verses 14 through 18, he lists some of the privileges the Jewish people finally enjoy in the Messianic kingdom. So in verse 14, he points out God will gather the Jews one by one until everyone is back into the land of Zion. In verse 15, at that day, God will give to Israel righteous, believing shepherds that will never again be guilty of leading the people astray. In verse 16, they won't so much as think of rebuilding the Ark of the Covenant. Because in verse 17, God himself in visible form in the person of the Messiah will rule from the city of Jerusalem. And in verse 18, the Jews will be so reunited so they'll never be split into two Jewish kingdoms again. But the enjoyment of all of these millennial or messianic blessings are conditioned by verse 13. Only confess your iniquity that you have transgressed against Jehovah your God. Notice again, the word iniquity is both singular and specific. There is one specific sin that must be confessed before they can enjoy the benefits of the Abrahamic benefits of the Messianic kingdom. Now, for a third passage, we will head for Zechariah chapter 12. And the prophet Zechariah, second back book in the back of the Hebrew Bible, Zechariah chapter 12. And look at verse 10. Let me also mention that the last three chapters of Zechariah are one prophetic revelation God gave the prophet, one discourse. What chapter 13 speaks about is Israel's forgiveness of their sins. As you go to chapter 14, he speaks of two more things. He speaks of the second coming in verses 1 through 15, and he speaks of the Messianic kingdom in verses 16 to 21. However, the second coming and kingdom of chapter 14 and Israel's cleansing from the sins of chapter 13 are all preconditioned by chapter 12, verse 10. I'll pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the spirit of grace and supplication. They shall look unto me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one is in bitterness for his firstborn. So before there can be a national cleansing of their sins, a second coming kingdom, what must happen first is Israel looking unto the one whom they once pierced. They'll have to mourn for him as one mourns for only son. In other words, until chapter 12, verse 10 is fulfilled, the prophecies of chapters 13 and 14 cannot be fulfilled. And now look at Hosea chapter 5, the first minor prophet, Hosea chapter 5. Now, throughout the fifth chapter of Hosea, it is God who is doing the speaking. God is still speaking. As we come to verse 15, where God says, I will go and return to my place until they confess their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me earnestly. Now, before one can return to a place, he must first leave it. After leaving it, he could then return to it. So God is speaking. God says he's going to return to his place, and God's place is heaven. So before God can return to heaven, he must first leave it. And when did he ever leave heaven? He left heaven at the incarnation when God became man in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. But then because of an offense, and notice the word offense is singular and definite, because of a specific offense committed against him, he did return to heaven when he ascended from the Mount of Olives. The verse goes on to say he will not come back to the earth until this offense is confessed. Adding a small warning, in their affliction, they will seek me earnestly. Now, what is the Jewish national offense committed against him? Not so much in killing him, and the ones that did the actual killing were Roman soldiers. But the national offense lies in rejecting him on the grounds of being demonized. Until that offense is confessed, there can be no second coming. And let's look at one more passage. This will be Matthew chapter 23. All of Matthew 23 is devoted to one theme, which is the Messiah's renunciation of the spiritual leaders of Israel, the scribes and Pharisees, for leading the nation astray. He pronounces seven woes upon them, but they form a circle. The first woe and the seventh woe deal with the very same sin. So the first woe in verse 13, the woe is for two reasons. First of all, they are rejecting his messianic claims, and secondly, they're leading the nation to reject him as well. Then comes the seventh woe in verses 29 through 36, which elaborate on the first woe. And what he says to them is they won't be held accountable only for rejecting his messiahship. They'll also be held accountable for all of the blood of the prophets of the Hebrew Bible. Because by this point of time, as he speaks these words, everything the prophets were going to say about the Messiah by now had been said. And the Old Testament canon had been closed for 4.5 centuries. So to reject him as the Messiah would automatically mean rejecting the prophets of the Hebrew Bible. And no Jew can claim, not even the most orthodox Jew can claim, to believe the prophets and reject his messiahship. It's a package deal. To believe one is to believe the other. To reject one is to reject the other. And so he says at the end of verse 36, verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. What generation? The generation of Messiah's time, the generation that actually committed the unpardonable sin of Matthew 12. When he closes this renunciation, he closes it with a lament. And in verse 37, he summarizes his 3.5-year ministry, how often longed to spread his hands out and give the city the messianic protection which was predicted by the prophets in the Hebrew Bible. But verse 37 ends with the phrase, ye would not. Literally in Greek, ye willed not, when they rejected him. So in verse 38, the house, a term for the Jewish temple, will lie desolate. It'll be destroyed 40 years after the Messiah spoke these words. And then look at verse 39, he's still addressing the Jewish leadership. For I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth until ye shall say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. From the Jewish frame of reference of first century Israel, that was the official messianic reading. Rabbis were teaching that whenever the Messiah comes, he must be welcomed with these words. For they arise out of a messianic psalm in the Hebrew Bible, Psalm 118 and verse 26. Psalm 118 and verse 26. And they never used these words till they first accepted him to be the Messiah. So here's the precondition to the second coming. just the Jewish leaders once led the nation to reject him, then they will have to come and they will lead the nation to accept him. And the basis of second coming involves two things. Number one, Israel must confess the national sin of rejecting him. And secondly, they must plead for the Messiah to return, to mourn for him as one mourns for only son. Until these two things happen, there'll be no second coming. Here's one of the key differences between the rapture and the church and the second coming for Israel. The rapture has no preconditions whatsoever. Could happen any moment of time, could happen tonight. And the rapture is part of God's program for the body of the Messiah, the church. But the second coming is his program for Israel. And it does have a key prerequisite, and that is Israel's national salvation. They must confess their national sin and they must plead for Messiah to return. Until these two things happen, there can be no second coming. Once we clearly understand the precondition, we understand Satan's activities as we're covering here. Satan knows that once the Messiah returns, his career is over. He also knows the Messiah will not come back until the Jewish people ask him to come back. So if he can wipe out the Jews before they have a chance to plead for Messiah's return, there'll be no second coming, and his career will be safe forever. That's why he's always been talking to Jews since the days of Abraham. And that's why things like the Crusades occurred. That's why things like the Russian pogroms occurred. That's why the Nazi Holocaust occurred. And that's why, as we see in Revelation 12, that once he's confined to the earth, he knows his time is short, 3.5 years before the second coming. And that's why he wants to wipe out the Jews as quickly as they can to avoid them coming to faith. So the first key application here is to understand the theological, biblical foundations of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, in any form, whether it's active or passive, whether it's social or political or racial or ethnic or theological or social, is part of the satanic war to avoid the second coming. Also understand the second important thing here. The second thing we'll understand is why Satan has used one name more than any other name to try to destroy the Jews. Since the 4th century, 95% of all persecutions against the Jews were the name of the three C's, the church, the cross, and Christ. 95% in the name of a false Christianity. Satan knows the name they have to call upon to bring him back, so he has a strategy to make the name odious in the Jewish community, and it has become odious. Now, most Jews know nothing about the Jesus of Scripture. They're reacting to the Jesus of Jewish and church history. But Satan has a specific reason why virtually a vast majority of the persecutions were not the name of Islam, but the name of Christianity. That brings us to the fourth application. That's where we must continue to practice and support Jewish evangelism. Because part of Jewish evangelism, as we've witnessed to Jews, we have to teach them to separate the difference between the Jesus of Scripture and the Jesus of Jewish and church history. Until the Jewish mind makes the separation, it'll be very difficult for him to consider that this Jesus could indeed be the Jewish Messiah. And so that's as far as we'll go with it at the moment. We'll pick it up more and in the later context. But so, coming back to this verse, the connection between chapter 12 and chapter 13 is this. In chapter 12, we have Satan's plan to total Jewish destruction to avoid the second coming. And chapter 13 now brings in the two individuals he will use to carry out that purpose. And that will be the Antichrist and the false prophet. So with chapter 12 and chapter 13, you have the organization of the counterfeit Trinity. And we'll pick that up after the next break. Here's your second Russian story. This was during communism, and synagogues were all closed down except for the showpiece in Moscow. And there were not many rabbis around under communism. The few that were there were followed by agents of the KGB. This one agent was assigned to keep eyes on the specific rabbi, and this rabbi did the same thing every morning. He would leave his flat and go over to Gorky Park. He would open these documents with strange writings the agent could not recognize and begin to meditate upon them or memorize them. He wasn't sure. So he felt, well, maybe his officers in the Kremlin need to know about this. So he wrote the rabbi and asked the rabbi, what is the strange writing and document you're trying to master? The rabbi says, oh, this is modern Hebrew. I'm trying to learn how to speak modern Hebrew. And the agent was a bit surprised and asked the rabbi, rabbi, you're an old man. At your age, why are you trying to learn a new language? And rabbi said, well, I did apply for an exit visa to be able to leave Russia. If they grant me the exit visa, I want to be able to move to Israel. They speak the language in Israel, and I want to be able to speak when I get there. Then the agent has some bad news for the rabbi and says, my officers in the Kremlin already informed me that they will turn down your request. You will now die here in Mother Russia. You may as well stop trying to learn this new language. Oh no, said the rabbi, I still have to learn it because if I die here, I'll go to heaven. They speak the same language in heaven. I won't speak it when I get there. So the agent decided to get smart with the rabbi and asked the rabbi, but rabbi, suppose you end up in hell instead. And the rabbi said, that's no problem. I already speak Russian.